Ladies and gentlemen, I can't really, it's great to be here and thank you all. How about 10 years? It's great to celebrate this 10th anniversary Florida Conference. We've come a long way since then. Looking at that list, I think Mike Sasso and I might be the only two people that still have the same job from 10 years back. We've come a very long way. And I'm proud to be here with all of you. And I'm really excited to welcome this illustrious panel entitled, What is General Common Law and How Do Originalist Textualist Judges Use It? And I'll get into the panel description briefly, but before I do, I just want to thank first those who've helped organize the panel. First, Judge Kat Mizell, who inspired the panel topic and was instrumental in bringing together much of this group, as well as my co-organizer, Elliot Peace, for his efforts, and of course, Lisa, Abby, and the whole FedSoc team for all that you do, not just for the help with this panel, but organizing this entire conference. So thanks to all those folks. And now into the panel. Brief description of what you're going to be hearing about today. Justice Antonin Scalia succeeded in making textualism the predominant method of legal interpretation. But now that an increasing number of jurists are committed to that method, the question of how to do it well has acquired an even greater urgency. However, there are fundamental disagreements. According to Professor Will Bode, textualists risk arriving at, quote, incomplete or misleading answers to important questions about the law, unless they learn to, quote, supplement plain text with unwritten law, law that governs both interpretation and background principles against which interpretation takes place. Is this unwritten law simply the canons of construction as articulated by the Supreme Court, pre-Erie general law, the natural law, the Anglo-American legal tradition, the common law of the states, or something else? The answer has important implications for judges, and it might vary depending on whether the litigant is in a federal or state forum, or whether the text to be interpreted is a statute, constitution, or a private law matter like a contract. For textualists, determining if, when, and how these unwritten sources of law should be consulted are amongst the most pressing issues of the day. Panelists will consider these questions from their various perspectives, from academia, and from the bench. And I can't think of a more appropriate and admired moderator for such an illustrious panel than right to my left, Judge Barbara Lagoa. I think it's worth noting, Mike went through that laundry list of folks that were present at the first conference, and one of the folks who was on a panel at that conference was Judge Lagoa, and I have a lot of admiration for her personally and professionally, and I can't think of a better person to host this panel. I'll give you a brief bio on her, although she needs no introduction. Judge Lagoa serves on the U.S. Court of Appeals for the 11th Circuit. Upon her appointment to the 11th Circuit, she became the first Hispanic woman and the first Cuban-American woman to serve on that court. She shared that same distinction as a justice on the Florida Supreme Court, and before that as a judge, including the chief judge, on Florida's third District Court of Appeal during her 13 years of judicial service to the state of Florida. Before joining the bench, Judge Lagoa practiced in both the civil and criminal arenas. Her work in private practice focused on general and complex commercial litigation in state and federal court. Judge Lagoa also served in the U.S. Attorney's Office for the Southern District of Florida as an assistant U.S. attorney, where she tried numerous criminal jury trials and handled a significant number of appeals. Judge Lagoa received her J.D. from Columbia University, where she served as an associate editor of the Columbia Law Review. She graduated cum laude from Florida International University, where she earned her B.A. in English and was a member of the Phi Kappa Phi Honor Society. Judge Lagoa resides in Miami with her husband and three children. So without further ado, ladies and gentlemen, please welcome Judge Lagoa.
Good afternoon and welcome to the first panel of the opening of the Federalist Society Convention in Orlando. Thank you for being here. As Charbel indicated, our first topic today is what is general common law and how do originalist textualist judges use it? I am looking forward to a very spirited debate among the distinguished panelists that we have today, and I've already indicated to two of them that they need to behave, because if not, Judge Thapar and I will take appropriate measures. I'm looking forward to this panel, and each speaker will present an opening of 5 minutes, and then we're going to follow the opening remarks with a moderated discussion, and I promise that we will leave 15 minutes for questions from the audience. And then the last 15 minutes, Professor Amar will be discussing his latest book. So it's now my great pleasure to introduce the speakers in the order in which they will be giving their opening remarks. Our first panelist is Professor Emily Brenner. She is a professor of law at the University of Notre Dame School of Law. She teaches and writes in the areas of administrative law, civil procedure, and business associations. Her scholarship focuses primarily on matters of procedural design and issues that arise at the intersection of public law and private ordering, with a particular focus on the use of privately developed technical standards in government regulations. She is a public member of the Administrative Conference of the United States, a small, freestanding federal agency charged with improving government processes, procedures, and performance, and as a council member of the American Bar Association Section of Administrative Law and Regulatory Practice. She's a regular contributor to the Yale Journal of Regulations Notice and Comments blog. Professor Brenner earned her BA in politics, magna cum laude from New York University, and her JD from New York University School of Law, where she was the executive notes editor of the NYU Journal of Law and Liberty, and she was a student editor for the International Journal of Constitutional Law. After law school, she clerked for Judge Kleinfeld in the United States Court of Appeals for the Ninth Circuit. She also practiced law as an associate in the Telecommunications and Appellate Litigation Group of Wiley Ryan in Washington, D.C., and served as a research chief of ACUS after joining the agency as an attorney advisor. Thank you, Professor Brenner, for being here. Our next presenter is going to be Professor Robert Leiter. He is an assistant professor of law at the Antonin Scalia Law School at George Mason University, where he teaches criminal law and torts. His scholarly interests are in criminal law, criminal procedure, and constitutional law, especially concerning questions about the use of force and the rule of law. He has written on the law of self-defense, the constitutional allocation of military power, and gun control. Before joining the Antonin Scalia Law School, Professor Leiter was at Arnold and Porter in Washington, D.C. He was previously at Mayor Brown and was an Olin Searle Smith Fellow at the University of Pennsylvania Law School. He clerked for Judge Diane Sykes of the United States Court of Appeals for the Seventh Circuit and Justice Clarence Thomas. Professor Leiter earned a BA summa cum laude from the George Washington University, a JD from Yale Law School, and a PhD in philosophy, where he defended with distinction his dissertation from Georgetown University. And while at Yale, he served as an articles editor for the Yale Law Journal. Thank you for being here. Next, we have my referee, hopefully. Not necessary, but we'll see. Judge Amul Thapar, who serves as a judge on the United States Court of Appeals for the Sixth Circuit. His judicial career began in 2007 when President George W. Bush nominated him to serve on the Eastern District of Kentucky, making him the first South Asian Article III judge in American history. In 2017, he became President Donald J. Trump's first appellate court nominee. Before joining the bench, Judge Thapar served as a United States Attorney for the Eastern District of Kentucky. While United States Attorney, he worked on the Attorney General's Advisory Committee and chaired its Controlled Substances and Asset Forfeitures Subcommittee. He also served on the Terrorism and National Security Subcommittee, the Violent Crime Subcommittee, and the Child Exploitation Working Group. Judge Thapar has worked in private practice and Williams and Connolly in Washington, D.C., and Squire Sanders and Dempsey in Cincinnati, Ohio. He's also served as an assistant United States attorney in both the Southern District of Ohio and the District of Columbia. Judge Thapar received his undergraduate degree from Boston College and his law degree from the University of California at Berkeley. After graduating, he clerked for Judge Arthur Spiegel of the United States District Court for the Southern District of Ohio and Judge Nathaniel Jones of the United States Court of Appeals for the Sixth Circuit. Judge Thapar has published in the Yale Law Journal, Michigan Law Review, and Catholic University Law Review. He teaches courses on originalism, the Federalist and Anti-Federalist, and legal writing at Notre Dame Law School, the University of Virginia School of Law, and Vanderbilt Law School. I'm exhausted by everything you do. Thank you for being here. And last, but certainly not least, is Professor Akhil Amar. He is Sterling Professor of Law and Political Science at Yale University, where he teaches constitutional law in both Yale College and Yale Law School. After graduating from Yale College summa cum laude in 1980 and from Yale Law School in 1984, he clerked for Judge, later Justice, Stephen Breyer. Professor Amar joined the Yale faculty in 1985 at the age of 26. He is Yale's only living professor to have won the university's unofficial Triple Crown, the Sterling Chair for Scholarship, the Devane Medal for Teaching, and the Lamar Award for Alumni Service. Professor Amar's work has won awards from both the American Bar Association and the Federalist Society, and he has been cited by Supreme Court justices across the spectrum in more than four dozen cases. He regularly testifies before Congress at the invitation of both parties, and in surveys of judicial citations and/or scholarly citations, he typically ranks among America's five most cited mid-career legal scholars. Professor Amar is a member of the American Academy of Arts and Sciences and has written widely for popular publications, including the New York Times, the Washington Post, the Wall Street Journal, and the Atlantic. He was also an informal consultant to the popular TV show The West Wing. I think I want to hear about that later. And his scholarship has been showcased on many broadcasts, including The Colbert Report, Tucker Carlson's Tonight, Morning Joe, 11th Hour with Brian Williams, Fox News at Night with Shannon Bream, Aaron Burnett Out Front, and Constitution USA with Peter Chagall. He is the author of more than 100 law review articles and several books, most notably The Bill of Rights, the 1998 winner of the Yale University Press Governor's Award, America's Constitution, the 2005 winner of the ABA Silver Gavel Award, America's Unwritten Constitution, in 2012 named one of the year's 100 best nonfiction books by the Washington Post, and The Constitution Today, in 2016 named one of the year's top nonfiction books by Time Magazine. His latest and most ambitious book, which he's going to speak about today, The Words That Made Us America's Constitutional Conversation, 1760 to 1840, came out in May of 2021. He's recently launched a weekly podcast, America's Constitution, which I do recommend listening to. It's very entertaining. A wide assortment of his articles and op-eds and video links to many of his public lectures and free online courses may be found at akhilamar.com. And as I indicated, Professor Amar will be talking about his latest book at the end of this presentation, and he also will be available to sign books afterwards. So are we ready to proceed? Let's open up the floor then to Professor Bremer. You have the floor.
Thank you. Good afternoon. I'm really glad to be here. Since I'm kicking us off, I'm going to start with some definitions. And I'm going to ask the question you probably all asked yourselves when you saw the title of this panel, which is, what is general common law? I'm going to use a definition that I pulled from an article that is forthcoming in the Stanford Law Review by Will Bode, Judd Campbell, and Steve Sachs, where they describe general law as conventionally unwritten law derived from general principles and customs and operating across jurisdictions. And I want to unpack that a little bit because it's actually a bundle of propositions that sort of independently and together provide a kind of antiquated conception of law, or at least one I think that we consider to be antiquated today. And it's an idea that law is these universal or general principles, this brooding omnipresence in the sky, right, that sort of exists independent of any jurisdiction, of any sovereign, and that is found by judges and then used to resolve the cases that come before them. And if you take this approach, then you believe that courts don't make law, right? They find it. And it leads to a very different methodology in terms of the lawyerly craft, right? Judicial decisions become evidence of the law, not the law itself. And one implication of that is that you can look to judicial decisions from any jurisdiction to get a sense of the general law, because it's not jurisdiction dependent and it's not made by those courts. It doesn't have force because of those decisions. Now, I think most of us are exposed to this idea of the general common law through Erie versus Tompkins when we take it during civil procedure, our first year of law school. And for those of you who have blocked it out, I'm going to remind you of the holding of the case. But I would distinguish actually between the holding of the case and then the conception of law that it not only established but reflected, right? And this is the 1938 decision of the Supreme Court in which the court held that there is no federal general common law, right? And federal courts sitting in diversity, that is deciding disputes where they have jurisdiction only because there are citizens of different states, apply the federal procedural law and the state substantive law. And state substantive law includes not just legislative enactments, which is what we would have understood to be local law, but also judicial decisions that come from the courts of that state, because courts make law, they don't just find it. Now, on the one hand, there's the holding, right, and the implications for many a tortured 1L civil procedure student. But then also Erie, in a really fundamental way, both made and describes the law that we understand today. Right? So at base, I think today we understand law to consist of the binding rules that are created by a sovereign authority and imposed on citizens. Right? It's a really positivist vision. Law is created. It is not found. It does not exist independent of a sovereign authority. It's a realist vision. It embraces the idea that courts do not just find or apply law. They make it as they decide disputes. Right? And if you take those propositions, you can see why we end up with some subsidiary commitments. For example, if law comes from a sovereign, then its content is jurisdiction dependent. Right? Now we care where the decision came from, because it's not evidence of a general thing, it is the thing. Right? And if law is made, including by courts as well as by legislatures, well then we can understand why you would have a greater commitment to legislative supremacy and a greater commitment to a reduced judicial role, because perhaps we would prefer that the people who make the law are the ones who represent the people and not people who are unelected. Now, why does this matter? Because like everybody's like everything I just told you, you knew, right? Like we've all heard this, I've heard this, I say this. And for the most part, I realized recently that it had been going sort of in one ear and out the other. That's nice. That's a historical development. And I realized recently that it can matter, and it can matter in the interpretation of statutes that are on the books today and that we have to interpret and apply. And I'm gonna briefly describe this to you and maddeningly go into no detail. But you may be aware that there's a dispute now over the authority of the federal courts to vacate agency action under the Administrative Procedure Act. The fight being whether or not the reference to set aside creates a remedy of vacatur or authorizes courts to issue the remedy of vacatur. And the debate is sort of proceeding on the idea that vacatur is a remedy, right? And all the remedy scholars, God bless them, including my colleague Sam Bray, who is very, very patient, has suffered many an argument from me, right? They look at this and they say there's no such thing as a remedy of vacatur. It doesn't exist. You have injunctions and habeas corpus and mandamus. You do not have a remedy of vacatur. And they're right. The thing is that the APA codified an appellate model of judicial review. And so if you look at set aside from the perspective of what an appellate court does, and you look at the appellate relationship that was developed in the early decades of the 20th century and then codified by the APA, it becomes immediately apparent that set aside is just a synonym for reverse or annul, and that it's naturally tied up with the standard of review. Now, how do you know this? Well, you go and you pull every single treatise on appeal and error and appellate practice from the Notre Dame Law School Library between 1892 and 1941, and you carry them back to your office, and you spend the entire Christmas break reading them, which I enjoyed. But when I'm writing this paper, I realize I'm trying to explain what the justices who created the appellate model would have understood to be the appellate relationship. And you're looking at all of the, these treatises that talk about appeal and error and look at cases from all jurisdictions. And I realized I have to explain why all these state cases are relevant to understanding the Federal Administrative Procedure Act. Because today we think of federal administrative law and then the administrative law of every single state. Like they're different, they're not related. But the people who were developing the law that was codified by the APA were general law lawyers and were educated in that methodology. And so for them, all of these decisions from different jurisdictions revealed the universal principles of the appellate relationship that later become codified in the APA. So if you don't understand that, you don't understand the perspective that they're looking at it from, then you're going to misinterpret the statute. You can't just start with the language and sort of go from there. You have to look at all of the sort of body of law that informed it. So I'll end there, because I think I took more than 5 minutes. I'm sorry.
That's fine. Professor Leiter.
So yeah, I think that's a great start and excellent definition of general law that I'm going to build on, and a good application of where you see general law being used. But I want to take my presentation and zoom out a little bit and talk about some of the other areas where you still see general common law. And if I had had technology, I was going to start with one of the scenes in the movie A Few Good Men, where one of the courtroom scenes where the trial's about two Marines who were charged with hazing another Marine. And during the trial, a third Marine, gets up and testifies that this sort of hazing is common at the military base. And this prompts a cross-examination where the prosecutor asks, well, where in the Marine Corps orders can I see that this sort of hazing should be allowed? And he said, it's not in the orders. This is just something that we do at Guantanamo Bay. So he pulls out the orders for Guantanamo Bay. He says, show me where in these orders in Guantanamo Bay you are charged with hazing another Marine. And then he concludes. He says, is there any set of orders, any written material that says that one of my duties is to haze other Marines? And he says, no. And this prompts Tom Cruise's character to do a redirect where he says, can you show me where the mess hall is? And he says, it's not in the book. And he says, wait, you've never had a meal at Guantanamo Bay? And he goes, no, I've had three meals a day. And he says, well, how do you know where the mess hall is if it's not in this book? And the Marine paused for a second. And he said, well, I guess I just followed the crowd at chow time. And I think this is important for two sets of reasons for the general law. One is the idea that the written materials are based on an assumption that not everything that is in the written materials is covered there. Some things are just based on things that are assumed. So the written orders for Marines probably include things like, what do you do if an officer enters the mess hall? Do you salute him or do you not salute him? But they don't state where the mess hall is or when you get to go there. And so there's this notion that you have written rules that supplement certain unwritten customs. And the second is where you find the unwritten, where you find the unwritten norms. And he follows the crowd at mealtime. He's saying here that he goes to see what the custom is, and that's what tells him where to go and when to eat. And so, where do we get law? One of the things I want to suggest is much of our law, both substantive and procedural, are not in the statute books. You will not find them there. And this is across a wide variety of domains. And so I want to start off also giving a shot at defining general common law. Slightly different definition, although I think one that is compatible with what Professor Bremer gave you. And I think general common law, there are two things to note. First, it is a type of common law by which it is an unwritten law grounded in legal customs that governs as the legal default rule until it is validly abrogated. And second, it is a general law. It is a common law that is shared among Anglo-American jurisdictions. And as Professor Bremer indicated, it is not either state or federal law, and no individual legal authority controls the general law, although they all may opine on it and expound it. So all jurisdictions can share and use it. No jurisdiction controls it. And I think Steve Sachs, who's a professor at Harvard, wrote this great article, Finding Law, where he compares it to the rules of etiquette. And you can have treatises that explain, you know, or the rules of fashion. Why are we all wearing, you know, all the men wearing suits and ties? Because that's the custom. Did anyone authoritatively dictate this custom? No. There are sources you can go to that tell you, you know, that advise you how to dress. But how do you know how to dress? Because you look around at what your peers do, and it's based on what the custom is. And the customs change over time. If you pick up a photograph of the 19th century, they don't dress this way. So the customs can evolve. They are not authoritatively promulgated, and yet we all share in them. You know, I, coming from Virginia, and many of you from Florida, still have shared norms of what the appropriate fashion is when we enter this room. Now, where is general law used? I think general law is used throughout the legal system. And let me give a non-exhaustive list of examples, and then I'll give some examples within each category. But I think, you know, general law is used throughout substantive criminal law, torts, conflict of laws, interstate relations, statutory interpretation, and constitutional law, including constitutional rights. And then keep in mind, as you think about this, until recently, common law was the primary law. Statutes were interstitial. If you pick up a copy of Blackstone, Blackstone is primarily a treatise on the common law with references to statutes as they're appropriate. Now, today, of course, there are a lot more statutes that are on the books. But the statutes that are on the books are not completely comprehensive and exclusive. Take criminal law. Criminal law is often thought of as an exclusively statutory domain. And in statutory jurisdiction, but this isn't quite true. Even in statutory jurisdictions, the common law often supplies the definitions and key elements of crimes. You know, the statute might punish attempt or conspiracy or solicitation. But even in the federal system has no definition of what these things are. The common law supplies that. The general law can also supply the defenses. Again, even in the federal system, where it's said that criminal law is exclusively statutory, the defenses are entirely common law. Congress has not passed a statute governing what the law is for self-defense, defense of others, the use of force in public authority, necessity, or duress. And, you know, without any sort of statutory law, I think you have two, you know, a judge who is faced with a self-defense case in a federal tribunal faces two options. Option number one, he can just make the law up in a very legal, realist sense. He can say, well, look, I get to put on my lawmaker hat, and let me just do what I think is the most convenient or reasonable law. Or second, without any sort of general law, a judge could say, well, look, Congress hasn't codified any law of self-defense, and therefore I'm not going to read it in. Federal law doesn't recognize a law of self-defense. And I don't think a judge would take either approach. I think a judge faced with this situation would look to general principles of common law and apply them. And that is, in fact, what the judges do. Torts, the definition of key torts, battery, assault, and negligence, are not defined by statute in most places. These are common law concepts, and these are common law concepts that are generally shared among Anglo-American jurisdictions. You may have differences at the margins, but for the most part, battery requires an intentional, harmful, or offensive touching. That's pretty shared across jurisdictions. Or interstate relations. If you want to know who has ultimate sovereignty over Ellis Island, the answer isn't found in a federal statute or any sort of federal law. And it's not the law of New York, and it's not the law of New Jersey. When the Supreme Court faced this in 1998, what did it look to? It looked to general principles to describe what you do when you have land that's in a body of water, and the body of water changes the land over time. And finally, in statutory interpretation, constitutional law, I think the general common law is important. So many statutes incorporate common law elements. Federal law says murder is the unlawful killing of a human being with malice aforethought. But notice, the statute does not define what is malice aforethought. It doesn't define the rule of causation or related rules like whether the year and a day rule applies. And you need general law to understand the Constitution. Article 1, Section 6 says that the senators and representatives, quote, shall in all cases except treason, felony, and breach of the peace be privileged from arrest during their attendance at the session of their respective houses and going to and returning from the same. Well, breach of the peace is an ambiguous term, and in common law it had two meanings. One, it could mean crimes that involve violence or some risk of public violence. And second, it could mean all crimes, because all crimes were deemed against the peace and dignity of the king. And if you want to know which definition applies to legislative privileges, you need to know the general law that applied to Parliament, because the Constitution is simply incorporating what that general law was. And so let me finish. I think I've taken up pretty much my time, but let me just hint at something. We can maybe get it out more in the Q&A. I think for originalists and textualist judges, the commitment to textualism is a commitment to certain rule of law values. But it would be a mistake to limit those values only to written law. I think there's a perception that somehow unwritten law is either not legitimate or anti-democratic because judges opine on it. And I think that's a mistake. I think unwritten law gets its legitimacy from being the custom of the community and from not being overturned by the democratic branches. And I think that long custom may be just as democratic as our imperfect legislative process. And I'm happy to talk more about that in Q&A, but let me end there.
Thank you so much. Judge Zafar.
Thank you for having me. I want to thank Lisa and her amazing staff, as well as the people who put together this fantastic conference that drew all you here. When I was in law school, they always told us that the A students would become professors, the B students judges, and the C students millionaires. And so it's an honor to be on a panel with a bunch of A students, but it's scary to have Professor Amar at the end who will grade what I do, and I do not want that grade back. So what I'm going to try and do, because I recognize that most of you are practitioners, is take some of this theory, and it actually works well from where Professor Leiter finished, and put it into more practical buckets about what the court is actually doing, meaning the Supreme Court and the lower courts, and hopefully that'll help how to use some of this theory in preparing briefs and arguments. And so what I see is I broke it into three kind of more practical buckets, and I'm going to start where the professor finished with the Constitution. So the way I think about the Constitution, I think most judges, especially originalist judges, think about the Constitution is that the framers ratified the Constitution against several background legal principles. And one of those, of course, was the common law we inherited from England. Thus, when we interpret the Constitution, we'll often look back at English common law to discern what the Constitution protects. And one recent example where the court was trying to figure out if there was an unenumerated right to abortion, they looked back at whether or not the common law protected or penalized that relevant activity. And that formed a portion of the court's analysis in Dobbs. The court also does this when it tries to define the scope of enumerated rights, as it did so in Crawford versus Washington. It consulted English common law when determining the scope of the Confrontation Clause. And in Galloway versus United States, the Supreme Court consulted the common law traditions when it concluded that motions for a judgment of law don't violate the Seventh Amendment right to a jury trial in civil cases. Now, moving to what Professor Leiter talked about right before that, statutory text, often judges and lawyers make the mistake, in my mind, of strictly interpreting the text without giving it context. And often common law and the common law backdrop can help lawyers and judges give it context. One example that Professor Bremer mentioned is that the Supreme Court has repeatedly stated that the Administrative Procedure Act was an effort to codify the relevant precedent in common law as it existed in the 1930s. And the court has relied on that when interpreting the Administrative Procedure Act. An example perhaps I like best is in Alanis versus United States. You'll remember that as the True Threats case. And there, Justice Alito wrote a concurrence when they didn't have mens rea in the true threat statute. And I loved Alito's concurrence because the majority sent it back to the lower courts to figure out what the relevant mens rea was. Justice Alito said, no, under Marbury, this is our job to say what the law is, and we should figure it out. So how would he figure it out, what to do? He wasn't going to impose, like, strict liability. None of the justices were. And so he looked back at the common law, and I'm going to quote him. He said, "Why?" And he found that recklessness would be enough. Why is recklessness enough? My analysis of the mens rea issue follows the same track as the court's, as far as it goes. I agree with the court that we should presume that criminal statutes require some sort of mens rea for conviction. To be sure, this presumption marks a departure from the way in which we generally interpret statutes. We ordinarily resist reading words or elements into a statute that do not appear on its face. But this step is justified by a well-established pattern in our criminal laws. For several centuries, at least since 1600, the different common law crimes have been so defined as to require for guilt that the defendant's acts or omissions be accompanied by one or more various types of fault, intention, knowledge, recklessness, or more rarely, negligence. Based on the background rules of common law in which the requirement of some mens rea for a crime is firmly embedded, indication of congressional intent expressed or implied to dispense with the mens rea as an element of a crime. And he goes on to go through and analyze it and find that recklessness was the appropriate standard. So when something like that is lacking, that's where you should go as practitioners. The final bucket I want to talk about just for a minute is kind of the common law, what I would call catch-all. And it's a body of laws that's derived from judicial precedent. If you think about like maritime law or law of nations and things like that. The thornier issue that I'd like to spend maybe one more minute on is at the founding, common law was seen as general law. It wasn't the law of Florida or Kentucky or the federal government, but rather backdrop principles of law that governed conduct in absence of a statute. This was the logic that underlied Swift, and it's the logic rejected in Erie. Under Erie, there's no general common law. Everything that falls into this third category of common law is either state law or federal law. Things like maritime or federal common law and your normal bar exam topics, contracts, property, torts, are state common law. Each has its own common law, and then there's federal common law for things like admiralty. But courts have recently recognized and been recognizing maybe for perhaps a little more, that Erie can be taken too far. For example, in a recent case, I noted in a separate writing the general common law problem with takings remedies. At the founding, the default remedy for an uncompensated taking would be a common law tort against the official inflicting the taking. It's similar to Professor Amar's thoughtful article, I think from 1994, although he'll know the year, my memory's not that good, in the Harvard Law Review about searches and seizures. And I definitely recommend you all read it. It might have been, was that the precursor for America's unwritten constitution? He says maybe. But that was what I was looking at was the remedial backdrop against which takings clause was ratified. Post-Erie, that regime does not work. Common law torts are contingent on state law, and it makes no sense to say your federally protected remedy under the takings clause is wholly contingent on state common law. Otherwise, the state could simply take your rights to property away. The court basically said this in Nick v. Township of Scott. And then, and I'll finish with this, in Tyler v. Hennepin County, it said state law cannot be the only source that defines property. And I'm quoting, the court will also look to traditional property law principles plus historical practice and this court's precedent. The last thing I'll say is that sounds similar, and Professor Leiter can tell you this in the Q&A, to what Professor Leiter and Professor Bode were saying about Bruin when they were talking about the general common law. Thank you.
Thank you. Professor Marr, you're last. And
so such an honor to be with you all. Judge Thapar mentioned, well, they're judges and they're professors and they're practitioners. He talked about a grading system. One thing that the judges and the professors have in common, it's a great thing. It's called tenure. And it frees us up to say all sorts of things. And although Professor Leiter, I think, was maybe even introduced as assistant professor, Judge Lagoa, he just mentioned to me that last week he got tenure. So I don't know that changed the title or not. But
not yet. Still has
okay,
to be.
Congratulations.
Yes, thank you. I wanted to invite you to be among the first to congratulate Robert Leiter. So since this is an event for especially practitioners, I want to reaffirm some pretty bedrock principles. I'm not sure that my friends on the panel are contradicting them, and on a bar exam or in a court, I'd want you actually to know that these are three kind of bedrock legal cases, and then we can talk about how this general law fits with that or not. The idea is coined in part by two of my students. I wrote letters of recommendation for both of them, the great Will Bode, my former head TA, and the great Steve Sachs. And ideally, they should be here to sort of articulate and defend their concept, and so we're kind of talking about them behind their backs. Maybe later we can talk about some of Will's other amazing ideas, including his thoughts about 14th Amendment Section 3, because he helped get that ball rolling, and General Barr is on the other side of that, so that's an interesting debate, you know, within us FedSoc folks. And Will has been on this free podcast that we have multiple times to defend his views about 14th Amendment Section 3. I'm on his side on that. I'm not sure I'm on his side on this general law thought, because I'm not really sure if it makes, in how it fits with American federalism conventionally understood. So I want to give you three bedrock cases. And if this general common law idea, general law idea, is inconsistent with these three cases, something's gone wrong. First one's from 1812. So these are founding era cases. It's the Marshall Court. Marshall may very well have been in dissent in this case, although silently. And Story also. It's called United States versus Hudson and Goodwin. And the basic takeaway of this case, it's really important. It's a bedrock landmark case in American jurisprudence. I'm going to quote from page 441 of this book that I'm plugging these days, The Words That Made Us. Here's what the court says. The legislative authority of the union, that is Congress, must first make and act a crime. It's got to tell us what the elements are. Affix a punishment to it. It's got to tell us, you know, is it death penalty, 10 years, whatever, and declare the court the child jurisdiction of the offense. So unless they do that, there is no federal law of sedition, of murder, of rape, robbery, not just in Florida, even on the high seas, anywhere. English courts recognize crimes without a statute, a parliamentary statute. State courts do that. You cannot do that in the federal system. That is absolute bedrock. Until Congress makes something a crime, it's not a crime. That's asymmetric, you see. Maybe there are additional defenses that are unwritten once the crime is articulated, but courts, federal courts, cannot come up with a federal crime. This was hugely relevant in the Sedition Act because John Adams said, oh, we're liberalizing English principles. We're recognizing truth as a defense in the Sedition Act. And people said, no. Without that Sedition Act, the baseline would be freedom. No federal law at all. Not English common law principles or general law principles of sedition or something like that. No, no, no. There is no federal common law of crimes. United States versus Hudson and Goodwin, 1812. That's rock solid 9-0 on the court today. So that's the first one. Then there's a second one. It's called Green versus Niels Lessee. It's 1832. Here's what it stands for. The U.S. Supreme Court, in the first case, it's out of Tennessee. It was a diversity case. It says, there's the state statute, and it means X. Fine. Then the Tennessee Supreme Court, subsequent to that first U.S. Supreme Court case, said, actually, we think it means Y. Now the issue returns to the U.S. Supreme Court in a third case. And maybe they're smarter judges, they understand, you know, the science of law better, but the question is whether they're going to stick to what they first said, because, you know, they're smarter, or they're going to actually listen to what Tennessee's Supreme Court says the Tennessee statute means. And they choose the latter course. Tennessee Supreme Court is the last word, generally speaking, on the meaning of Tennessee statutes, and that's true, you know, for the other states. This is proto-Erie, you see. It's doing for statutes what Erie will do for lex non scripta, for, you know, common law. Now, the third one is Erie. Here's the famous sentence from Erie, and I just want you to keep this, you know, in mind on your bar exam or in front of a judge. Except in matters governed by the federal constitution or acts of Congress, the law to be applied in any case, not just in diversity cases, any case, is the law of the state. And whether the law of the state shall be declared by its legislature in a statute glossed by the state Supreme Court, or by its highest court in a decision, is not a matter of federal concern. There is no federal general common law. That was a case involving trespass, okay? And they're saying, we don't have a federal trespass rule. There's no general law of trespass. That's up to the states to decide. Of course, in just real estate, what could be more local than that? If they had a statute, that statute would be binding on us under the rules of, under the Rules of Decision Act and the 10th Amendment, and not just in diversity cases, even if it were a pendant, you know, federal question case. There's an environment, federal environmental law statute, and count two is some, you know, trespass claim. It could be in a statute, and the statute is going to mean what the state Supreme Court says it means, Greens versus Niels SC, or could be unmade law, judge law, excuse me, unwritten law. And if there are different rules for that, there's going to be a lot of pressure for codification. Oh, the state's simply going to codify its judge-made law in statutes, and then that's going to bind the federal courts. So I want you to keep those three basic principles in mind, you know, the cases. Hudson and Goodwin, Green versus Niels SC, Erie, they're all bedrock. If you want to read more about what they really mean, the two maybe greatest law clerks of Justice Brandeis who wrote that opinion are Henry Hart at the Harvard Law School and Henry Friendly. You could read Article 1954, Columbia Law Review by Henry Hart, The Relations Between State and Federal Law. You could read a decade later Henry Friendly's classic article in the New York University Law Review in praise of Erie and the new federal common law. There are pockets of federal common law, and Amol told you, like, admiralty is one. So we'll have to talk about all of that. If I've gone too far, I'll shut up now. If I haven't, maybe in the Q&A, I'll tell you one really interesting, cool thing about background legal principles and how you interpret the Constitution itself. But maybe I've gone over already.
Thank you. Thank you all to the panelists. I'm going to open up just general questions to the panelists, and then I'll direct also questions. I'm going to be nice, and I'm not going to ask Professor Lager still a question about whether or not you agree with Professor Amar just yet. I'll go soft first. First question I have is for the panel is, in Professor Caleb Nelson's 2006 Columbia Law Review article called The Persistence of General Law, he defines general law as, quote, rules whose content is not dictated entirely by any single decision maker, state or federal, but instead emerges from patterns followed in many different jurisdictions. Do you believe that that's an accurate understanding of general law? Or, and more importantly, how do courts legitimately find and apply general law?
I mean, I think that's exactly right. I think the idea of general law is, not, you know, is, again, two things. One is that it's an unwritten or common law, but second, that it is a common law that is shared among many different jurisdictions. And so you do look to the pattern of decisions, and I think we do this in a lot of common law cases. I think we do this in a lot of other cases, too, such as the meaning of the Constitution. And, you know, maybe today we would say, well, this rule governs this legal system and its persuasive authority, but what is often happening is a very general law enterprise. And I think, you know, and I think the general common law has sort of continued with academic projects like the Restatement of Torts or the Restatement of Contracts, which I guess in their better moments, the restatement purports to be a restatement of the general law principles. And its less good moments, it is often trying to recreate them. and reform them. But, you know, the restatements are at least in theory supposed to be restating these sorts of legal principles that exist across many different jurisdictions.
Although it is interesting that there are some pockets where it was general common law and now it's not, right? So administrative law is like a really great example of this, right? Early administrative law treatise, and it doesn't emerge as a field until the early 1900s, really, and then we start having fights over if there is a such thing as a general law of administrative law and what it can, you know, what it consists of. But all those early treatises, they look at state cases, they look at British, like they're comparative across nations. And after the APA, that's dead.
Just dead.
We don't do that anymore at all.
Well, two thoughts. Once you have a statute, you see, it's ultimately what the statute says. Now, if it's a transitional statute, if it's a statute passed in the 1940s and the people who adopted it, the Congress, are lawyers who kind of are pre-Erie, then those pre-Erie sensibilities might be useful to understand that statute from the 1940s, but it's not how you would interpret a statute passed today, you see. So that's one point. The second point, it really does matter a lot whether it's a restatement project that states are free to embrace or not, state by state, or whether it's some federal thing that's binding on every state. And Erie, just to remind us, says there's no federal general common law. There are pockets. But once there is a federal law, here's the title again of Henry Friendly's article, In Praise of Erie, okay, fine, any clerk for Brandeis, as did Friendly, and the new federal common law. Wait a minute, how can you praise Erie if you're praising the new federal common law? He says, it's not across the board, it's in certain pockets. And once you do it, you have to defend the relevant federal interest that underlies your federalization of an area, and it's going to bind every state court, whether they like it or not, whether they agree with it, and it's no different than your gloss on a federal statute. And sometimes federal statutes, as Robert says, they're very open-ended. The Sherman Antitrust Act, all sorts of federal laws. Federal courts are going to fill in all those gaps, but those are going to be binding on state as a matter of federal law.
So I have a follow-up question, which is, what do you then envision are legitimate sources of general law today? Well, is it just the canons, or is it more?
Let me identify just one thing, since I teased it before. This is the book that Amul mentioned, America's Unwritten Constitution. Oh, so I do think there are unwritten principles. And surely, if you've looked at the written text, you see there are unenumerated rights. It's asymmetric. So surely there are more rights than are textually specified. And how do we find them? In part by counting states. That's the Glucksberg test that is Dobbs. That's how we think about maybe privileges and immunities above and beyond the incorporated rights. It's how we think about the Ninth Amendment. So there's all of that. That's unwritten. But the written text itself invites that, gestures toward it. But here's the most interesting thing. Yes. The rules of interpretation, not just of statutes or 1940 statutes, the APA, the rules of interpretation of the Constitution itself, see, because the Constitution doesn't specify those, and even if it did, you'd have to have rules for interpreting the rules of interpretation, and there'd be an infinite regress. Here's the most interesting one, to my mind. It's actually, this is how I begin the book. It's a law joke. It's not a lawyer joke, because I don't tell lawyer jokes because, you know, lawyers don't think they're funny and ordinary people don't think they're jokes. So this is a law joke. We'll see who laughs first. This is how I begin the book. Who presides, when you actually read the Constitution, you know, and you should read the Constitution, who presides at the vice president's impeachment trial? No one's laughing yet? Okay, because when you read this, it's absolutely clear that the Senate tries all impeachments. It does. And the vice president is the presiding officer of the Senate. She is. And there are two and only two exceptions. When the president is impeached, but the chief justice presides, but in my hypo, it's the vice president. And when the vice president isn't there, it's the president pro tempore, but she's there and would like the gavel, please. So when you read this, it's utterly clear that the vice president presides at her own impeachment. It's also utterly clear that that cannot be right, because there are background principles of interpretation, the absurdity doctrine, the idea that no person can be a judge in his or her own case. They go back thousands of years to Cicero through Blackstone, and if I persuade you of this, and it's the first 10 pages of the book, I've just sawn a lady in half in front of your eyes, because I've shown you the document not only sometimes means more than what it says, unenumerated rights, but the exact opposite of what it says if you just use a dictionary and an AI machine about what words mean. That's interesting, and that's unwritten.
Can I just note really quickly, I think the if you take the sort of like absolute extreme versions of general law and positive law, they both have folly, right? General law's folly is to assume that you can have law without anyone ever saying what the law is. And positivist is the folly there is that you can write down what the law is and have answered all the questions without needing someone to come in and fill in the gaps. And it's like, I think our textualist, the last several decades of textualism are beginning to show people that actually we need to fill gaps, and we have to look somewhere to fill those gaps in a legitimate way. And part of the sort of current conversation, I think, is an attempt to find that middle ground.
And so what do you think the legitimate tools would be to find what the unwritten general law is?
I mean, I think it's heavily context dependent, right? I mean, I think you have to look to existing judicial decisions and other, you know, and sometimes, you know, old common law. I mean, in the context of the APA, and if you're talking about the procedural provisions, talking about the hearing provisions, looking at pre-APA due process judicial decisions is a legitimate way to fill the gaps in the statute, because that's what they were codifying, for example. So I think it's very context dependent, but usually you're going to find that there was some body of law that someone had thought about this that's going to give you some guideposts. And then, of course, we have interpretive principles, canons of construction, some of which are going to be substantive, that are going to give us guideposts to say, well, if there's a gap and there's no sort of clear indication of how to fill it, then we have to reason from the sort of guideposts that the legislature gave us in other parts of the statute to come up with principles that fill those gaps in a way that's consistent with the overarching scheme.
And I think one of the issues, and Judge Sapra, you made me talk about this, which is, I think as judges, the Supreme Court hasn't really articulated or explicitly described what are the best canons to use or what are the best traditional tools for statutory construction. And so we're sort of left to figure out which tools we should use in that toolbox.
Yeah, and I mean, I would say that when you're writing a brief, I would always put linguistic canons above substantive canons. I think courts are much more hesitant to employ substantive canons, whereas we're always willing to use linguistic canons. I've tried to figure out how the Supreme Court ranks the canons or thinks about the canons so that we employ them at the appropriate time, meaning the substantive canons. And Justice Barrett, when she was a law professor, wrote an interesting article. I have it and I can cite it, but she wrote an interesting article about linguistic versus substantive canons, and I think it's worth looking at.
Canon and faithful agency?
Yes.
Oh. I think a point of agreement and point of disagreement with some of my colleagues here. Agreement, I think they're right about how you figure out what the general common law is. I mean, imagine if you had a self-defense case in a federal enclave where there was no binding law to apply. What would you do? I think the first thing you would do is look for judicial decisions that apply in that jurisdiction. If they didn't exist, you would look to judicial decisions in neighboring jurisdictions to see if they coalesce around certain principles. And you would also go to treatises or other scholars of the law to see what they said. And if that failed, then you go to the principles that Professor Amar mentioned and Professor Bremer, either the canons or the principles, like no one can be a judge in his own case. So I think these are the traditional tools for deciding unwritten law. One thing I do disagree with is the idea that general law is set as opposed to positive sources of law, i.e. written law. I don't think unwritten law and positivism are incompatible. Positivism is the idea that law consists of social conventions rather than some sort of natural law theory. And I think that general law can consist of is positivistic in the sense that where do you find common law? You find it in the customs of the community, and those customs are social facts.
I'd want you just to remember, even when you're dealing with a federal statute has a gap in it, uses a word, doesn't define that word, it is not always the case that that word, even in a federal statute, will mean the same thing in the 50 states. And if you're interested in this, the classic article is by Professor Paul Mishkin. It's in the 1957 University of Pennsylvania Law Review. It's called The Variousness of Federal Law. He was one of the editors of Hart and Wexler. Here's an example. Copyright is a distinctively federal domain. It's mentioned in Article 1, Section 8. Oh, well, you know, and when the author dies, the author's family gets the royalties. But who's the author's family? Say in 1960, does a live-in, a common-law spouse count? Do illegitimate children count? Now, today some of these have been constitutionalized, so it's one size fits all. But in 1960, the same federal copyright statute would treat, you know, who's the author and who's the author's family differently in the different states, because it would actually, in effect, be properly understood, argues Mishkin, as incorporating by reference the law of the author's home state. And in some home states, in 1960, common law spouses counted as family for the rest of the estate, and in other states not, or illegitimate children, or what have you. So today, you make the same this is a sore spot for me, but you're going to be happy. Same federal income, okay? But you and I are going to pay different taxes ultimately. Our federal income tax, because actually we get to deduct state taxes, and you have no state taxes here in Florida, and I've got state taxes in Connecticut, and so actually we're going to end up paying. I'm going to end up paying less federal, but you're going to end up paying less overall. You see, because that federal income tax means something different in the 50 states. We don't have a general law of deduction or something. We have a federal statute that incorporates by reference the positive laws of the 50 states. Federal statute means different things. A federal statute in the different states. Wow.
So educate the judges. I'd be curious what you all think about contracts and property. If you look at the Constitution, it protects property, both the due process and the takings clause, and contracts, the contracts clause, from state governments. But if contract and property common law were purely state law, then states could simply say you never had a property right and you never had a contract, and they could completely sidestep the Constitution's protections.
Right, and that's why we have landmark cases like Ward against Love County and Martin versus Hunter's lessee that prevent that. That said, even today, let's take the Fourth Amendment, some states may be able to give you, let's say against the feds themselves, more protection. There may be like baseline, there has to be at least a minimum amount. Let's take, for example, a situation where the FBI, not the local cops, the FBI, are rooting around in your trash. Now, there's a case called California versus Green where it says, well, once you put in that opaque green trash bag and you stick it out in, you know, on the curb, it's not yours anymore and you have no Fourth Amendment interest, so too bad, so sad. But if a state chooses to give you a property right above and beyond, you know, in your garbage, that gives you a property right perhaps not just against state officialdom, but against the federal officialdom, but again, maybe only in that state, until, Robert, enough states do that. And when enough states do that, federal courts are going to say, this is now, you know, they're going to reinterpret the Fourth Amendment, Glucksberg-like, Dobbs-like, to say there's now a higher baseline of general property interests, even, you know, in the outlier
so
states.
So, Professor Amar, would you say unreasonable in the Fourth Amendment means against the state common law?
Sometimes. It's not, you know, yes, all the time. Let's take cruel and unusual punishment. When enough states, you know, there was a time perfectly usual to hang pickpockets, read Dickens.
But then aren't you saying that states can effectively change the Constitution?
No, what I'm saying is the Constitution itself incorporates by reference state law in all sorts of interesting ways. And when enough states change their law. Sometimes that changes it even for the outlet. Let me just give you the example.
That would be an argument that Kennedy versus Louisiana is right.
Yeah, well, it might be. Okay, because here's what Scalia writes, in my view, a not great book, truthfully, called The Matter of Interpretation. And I wrote the foreword to the new edition, and I say that in the foreword to the new edition. I said, it's good, it's not great, he misses some stuff. I'm a very straight shooter, okay? So.
He was an A student, though. Remember, he was a professor.
Well, we can talk about that. Okay, so he says, gee, how can it be that what was once perfectly everywhere, like the death penalty, is now unconstitutional? And I said, well, here's how it can be, because he has this debate back and forth. Let's take not the death penalty as a whole, but death penalty for pickpockets. I promise you, and Judge Legault was an English major, you see that, you know, if you read Charles Dickens, if you read Oliver Twist, it was totally common, usual, at a certain point in time, to hang pickpockets like the Artful Dodger. Totally. And today, I promise you, 9-0, that is unconstitutional. What happened? Here's one thing that happened. What was usual at a certain point became unusual. And it became unusual when state by state by state started actually eliminating death penalty for pickpockets. I could do the same thing for low IQ or underage offenders. And at a certain point, Judge, when enough states did it,
but you're suggesting
the outliers were forced
that
to go.
The states can then influence general law.
Yeah.
So that if you had 40 states who decided that they were going to recognize pedophilia, that would now become okay under general law?
That's Gob and Glucksberg. Let's take something from this state. Gideon versus Wainwright, the last paragraph of the opinion, says the following. It has a bunch of other arguments, too. 45 of the 50 states are already recognizing rights of, appointed counsel for indigents. Of the remaining five, of which Florida was one, even they recognize appointed counsel for capital offenders, and even they typically, among the five, recognize appointed counsel for their big cities. And therefore, says the Supreme Court, this isn't me, the outliers have to get on board as a matter of right of counsel.
But it's
got interpreted in the light of evolving state practices. You could call that general law if you wanted.
But doesn't this cut against your eerie federalism point?
So if it's going to be true, it's going to be, there are pockets of federal common law. This is the new federal common law, and one of those pockets is called constitutional law. And once the court calls it constitutional, that applies to everyone.
So you think the Supreme Court will reverse this term in de Villiers?
That's the
Texas taking? Flooding case.
Yeah, I actually worked with the private property plaintiffs in that case, some of whom are my students, and I think they deserve to win, yeah.
Yeah.
So, Professor Leiter, I'm going to ask you if you agree with Professor Amar that United States v. Hudson, where the court concluded that federal courts lacked common law jurisdiction in criminal cases, was correctly decided.
I mean, I don't know. The decision was certainly controversial at the time. It was not this lodestar of federal criminal jurisprudence. I also don't think it matters much for our debate because, you know, whether you're talking about this or Erie, you're kind of talking about at what point would some sort of general common law be binding, and that may be very broad, it may be narrower, but that doesn't obviate that there is general common law and that it's used for certain purposes. I do disagree with Professor Amar, though, that the legislature has to define the act that's a crime. I don't think Hudson goes that far. Hudson says, as he noted, that it has to make an act a crime, but that doesn't mean it has to actually define the elements. So take 18 U.S.C. 1651, which punishes piracy. It says, quote, whoever on the high seas commits the crime of piracy as defined by the law of nations and is afterwards brought into or found in the United States shall be imprisoned for life. So note that federal law there does not define what the crime is. The law of nations supplies the definition, and you can't know what piracy is without having some background knowledge of the law of nations. And the Supreme Court has upheld this definition as adequate. So I do think that you know, Hudson does require that Congress basically authorize criminal jurisdiction and affix the penalty and declare the act a crime. But whether it's piracy, attempt, conspiracy, or a whole bunch of other crimes, Congress has not defined the elements.
Well, thank you to the panel. I had promised 15 minutes of questions, and we've run a little bit over. But let's throw the floor open to questions. I see that we have one individual there.
Yeah, hi. This is for Professor Amar. Can you hear me here?
Yes.
Okay, Professor, I'm Rod Sullivan. I'm a former professor of con law at Florida Coastal.
Hey.
In the Colorado disqualification case, the trial court analyzed the disqualification clause of the 14th Amendment and said it only applies to three people. It applies to senators, congressmen, and members of the Electoral College. Now, you have opined that any officer of the United States can be disqualified under the disqualification clause. Was the trial court in Colorado acting as a textualist, and are you acting as a living constitutionalist in coming to that conclusion?
So I'm so glad you asked that. And Will Bode has been on my podcast. We've talked about this on several episodes, and this is about Will Bode. So first, I wrote an amicus brief in the case, and you can take a look at it. It cites, by the way, twice Hudson and Goodwin, which I think is a very, very important case for various general propositions. So I agree that Hudson may or may not, you know, just how we can talk about the details, but the core of Hudson and Goodwin, oh, don't get that wrong on the bar exam. That's actually absolutely emphatic. So I have an op-ed. It's coming out in the New York Times on this issue, I think on Tuesday. I think my side might lose on 14th Amendment Section 3. We will not lose on whether the president is an officer. My friend Bill Barr is going to be speaking this evening. He's written a brief on the other side. I will buy you lunch if he gets more than three votes. I'm not even sure he gets three. So that's actually pretty easy and obvious that the president is an officer of the United States. I, Donald J. Trump, do solemnly swear that I will faithfully execute the office of President of the United States. Impeachment actually talks about removing a president from office. He is an officer, as in commander-in-chief. Federalist 69 calls him, an officer elected 4 years. There are hundreds of references to presidents as officers. When the 14th Amendment was adopted, hundreds of people said, of course it applies to the president. Of course we don't want Jefferson Davis to be eligible to the presidency. Not one person has ever been identified who asserted the contrary in 2 years of deliberation. So yeah, that's easy. I'm a textualist. It's presidents are officers. And texts are how people use them in context. And no one thought otherwise at the time of the 14th Amendment. No one. So that one's pretty easy, truth be told. But we will see over the next week what happens. There are issues in that case about self-execution, about what's an insurrection, about what fact-finding procedures need to be engaged in, whether you need a conviction, or lots of issues. But I don't think this president officer thing is actually going to have any traction at all. That's actually a bold prediction in advance in front of you all. We'll see next week.
Ashley, next.
Thank you, Your Honor. First, as a predictive matter, if it ever came before the court, I don't think the people's justice would say that hanging pickpockets is unconstitutional. So I don't think it would be 9-0. But let's put that to one side.
My question is unconstitutional?
In my opinion, no, it's not.
They've already said emphatically that you can't, and this may change in Florida because of rape law that's being proposed now. You can't actually put to death anyone who, unless a victim actually died and the defendant actually did it. That's
they have the
Supreme
judgment
Court
power.
Today.
That doesn't mean they're right. But let's put that to one side. My question is mostly for Professor Leiter and Judge Thapar. I'm more of a Swift guy than an Erie guy. I do think that law can be discovered as opposed to just made. My question is about whether the law has to be general across the Anglosphere. To use your mess hall example, which is obviously stylized, in Louisiana, which has heavy French influence, they sit down for lunch at 2 o'clock and it goes 3 hours. And when they're strolling out at 5 p.m., people in Naples are sitting down for dinner. So the customs across even our country, let alone the Anglosphere, are pretty different. And so if you say that the general law really has to be general across the entire Anglo-American world, are you taking away the ability to have sort of different customs and mores in our federalist system? And isn't that problematic since, much to my chagrin, the people of California are very different than the people of Florida and many other states across the union?
I mean, I'm glad you asked that because I think this was another point that I didn't get out, but would like to. So I think the general common law is the law that is generally applicable. I don't think it's the law that is applicable in every jurisdiction. And I think it's important to note that just because general common law exists doesn't mean it is binding on a particular jurisdiction. Jurisdictions can choose whether to go with the general common law or not. And so I keep coming back to, you know, this example of a federal self-defense law. I think if a court is asked to create a federal self-defense law, it will first turn to the general law to see what that said. I can't guarantee you that a federal court would always adopt the general law of justification, whether it's self-defense or the right to resist an officer who is unlawfully arresting or searching. You know, maybe they reject the general law. So there are, you know, there is room for what Blackstone would have called special common law or common law that is local to a jurisdiction. We see that a lot in property. A lot of property law is local to particular jurisdictions and rejected the kind of general common law principles that were then pre-existing, especially in the western states. So just because general common law exists doesn't mean that a jurisdiction is bound to apply it. Jurisdictions can choose whether to accept the general law rule or to create a special local rule.
But I have a question. Historically, the United States Supreme Court did not decide what the general common law was. Or at this point in time, could they make a decision and say that we have general common law and then all the states would have to apply it?
Yeah, no, I don't think the Supreme Court could do that. I think the Supreme Court could issue its opinion on what general law is, and much like somebody opining on the rules of fashion, its opinion will go in with everyone, you know, with everyone else's. But the Supreme Court makes mistakes, and I think one area where it got the general law profoundly wrong was in the constitutional law domain in Kelo versus New London, where you had the takings clause question. And I think you see a lot of state courts saying in a kind of post-Erie way that the court got the general law wrong, and you know it uses the modern independent adequate state law doctrine not to follow it, but I think it's a condemnation of what the court concluded in that case.
So I think of it slightly different just because I think more in buckets again, but I think that the general law or the common law, whatever you want to call it, for bare minimum constitution purposes is different than what the states do. And so the states can say, they can call, California can say, we're not a property state anymore. You all lose your property. And the federal courts should not, under some version of Erie, defer to that and allow California to take everyone's property under the Fifth Amendment. And so, and I think that's where the Supreme Court is going in the property cases specifically. If you look at Nick, you look at the South Carolina case where Justice Scalia said he was applying South Carolina law, but he looks at the restatement, he looks at general nuisance law. If you look at where they're gonna go probably in de Villiers, and my friend Andy Oldham's dissent kind of lays this out and says there's no way states can effectively take away your Fifth Amendment rights by redefining property and not giving you a way to vindicate it. It can't be that you can only vindicate it in state court and then state court can say you have no right to vindicate it.
Once you say something's in the Constitution, of course, that's binding on everyone. Now, Swift, you like Swift. Swift did not apply its rules to state court. Swift said, this is how we hear this diversity case, but the very same diversity case across the street in state court, we're not going to impose it. And that created some real problems for citizens and parties. So under the new federal common law, this is Henry Friendly's very important article, once a federal court says, this is a matter of federal law, oh, that's binding on state courts, just like a statute would be. And the one final, thing, and then I want to... Forget criminal law for just, even you can take criminal, federal criminal law, what's the statute of limitations? Sometimes you know, a federal court, because if the statute doesn't say, sometimes a federal court will just read one in and just create a one-size-fits-all general statute of limitations. The more common approach, and this is also true on the civil side, is to borrow state statutes of limitation, even for federal causes of action, which means the same federal statute, civil statute, is going to mean something, in effect, different in the 50 different states, which have different rules of statutes of limitation.
So, Ashley, I think we're getting, in some sense, to the world you want in the way the court is going, at least as I understand it, which is we'd have a version of SWIFT and a version of Erie, and the version of Erie would be federal courts would defer to states in interpreting their own law, but federal courts are not going to allow states to get rid of constitutional rights or add constitutional rights by doing things.
I like the second half of that. I don't like federal courts deferring to state courts because that's just judicial supremacy. But, yeah.
Thank you, Ashley. I didn't see you. I'm sorry. You have a question?
Yes. Thank you, Judge Lagoa. Good afternoon. Professor Leiter, you posed the question when you mentioned that the common law is democratic, and I think you're getting at because the people through their elected representatives haven't abrogated the common law. But the way I see it, the common law is a product of philosopher judges appointed by the king back in England, and going back to Roman law promulgated by the emperor, and then arguably even biblical law. So I don't see how the common law is a democratic form of law. It seems to me to be anti-democratic.
I mean, I think this is a common objection, especially in textualist circles. And so a few things. One, I think that, you know, I think this is kind of a post-legal realist way of viewing it, that someone had to promulgate it, and therefore it was the judges who had their commissions. And I don't think the common law necessarily started that way or had to start that way. You know, it could very well start as just customs that were widely recognized in the community, and the judges could be saying, hey, we have these customs, we recognize them, and so their opinions are just validating what was the de facto state in the community anyway, rather than saying, we promulgate this to be the law. I think second, you have to keep in mind that you're not just looking at the legitimacy of statutes or common law in the abstract, but you also have to compare them to each other. And statutes are not perfectly democratic either. They're, you know, statutes sometimes get passed without majority support. Sometimes they can't be repealed even when a repeal has majority support. Legislatures have all sort of veto gates. Where it becomes very difficult to legislate. And so I think there is much legitimacy in having customs that the community has inherited for hundreds of years and has never overturned. And I think that legitimacy is just as strong as many of our federal statutes, which often predate my lifetime. And, you know, why does the dead hand of the past, govern today? I think because, in part, we assent to it by not repealing it, and because of whatever underlying legitimacy the statutes have. And I don't think it's any different on the common law side, just because that law is unwritten.
I completely agree with that. I would also say that there were notions of due process that defined what it means to exercise an appropriate judicial discretion that require judges not to make decisions based on whim or caprice or ill motive or just randomly or by a flip of a coin. It required them to draw on the sort of common customs in resolving the disputes that came before them. And I mean, the other thing is it's democratic in the sense that if you don't want a judge to resolve your dispute, you resolve your dispute yourself. Right? I mean, you are submitting to the jurisdiction of the court to resolve your dispute, presumably originally because we wanted an alternative to stabbing to resolve our disputes, right? And once you decide to do that, like you put in place rules so that you're not just having someone else do the stabbing, right? And that's where we get these concepts that constrain discretion, and I think is a lot more than just the appointment of philosopher kings.
But on stabbing, I want you to just take seriously United States versus Hudson and Goodwin, because they're judges. And here's, this is big and important. State judges can create on their own a criminal offense called stabbing. Federal courts cannot. That's 9-0 today. That's on the bar. And federal courts are not directly elected in the same way that today most state courts are. So
I don't know what state court you're talking about, because that never happened in my court.
But state judges are allowed to recognize new crimes or find them. And they could say this is based on the custom of our community, all the rest. But they, the common law offenses, criminal offenses, murder, rape, robbery, mayhem, arson, burglary, were initially created not by statute, lex scripta, but by judges. Now, in America, again, states have always typically had that. Federal courts have not, and it is interesting that federal courts are not as directly electable and reelectable as state judges are.
One very quick follow-up to that. I don't agree that if state judges did that, that they would act legitimately. And as I said earlier, I think to be a textualist or an originalist is to commit yourself to certain rule of law principles. And those rule of law principles extend to the unwritten law. And so when you find common law crimes, what you are supposed to be finding are the customs of the community that have existed through long usage. It's not a license to go make it up. Right. And when state judges do this, which they do in the post-legal realist realm, I think, you know, this is the kind of activism that I think is highly problematic.
You're missing the point. Even when it's utterly customary and it's perfectly legitimate for a state court to do it, it is never legitimate for a federal court to do it, even if it were deeply rooted in custom. And one reason might be there's not a national custom on many things the way there might be within a given state. So to repeat, federal courts can never do this. State courts have always done it, and sometimes it's been utterly legitimate, and this cuts across where you think they're making or finding. But state courts can do it, federal courts cannot on the criminal side, and that's Law 101.
Professor Amar, we have 3 minutes before our panel is over if you would like to talk about your book.
Read it. You don't have to buy it.
Read it, buy it, sign it.
No, you don't have to buy it. I'm asking, this is a big ask. The most it's an honor to be with you all. I'm asking you to give the most, what is most precious to you, which is not your money. You guys are rich. They have no taxes down here in Florida. So you get to keep what you make. I'm very envious, you know, especially when I'm trading up 20 degrees and looking at beautiful koi, you know, in the middle of winter. Here's the problem. We're a very deeply divided country, and the only thing that we have in common is our constitutional narrative. The text and the history behind it, because we have nothing else. We don't have ethnicity or race or religion, even geography. So we have to know our Constitution, and my honest, I'm a blunt person, challenge is, I'm not sure that we do. I'm not sure that even this distinguished audience does. So I'm trying to write books that actually tell you what America has been about. Took me years to write. It will only take you weeks to read, but it will take you weeks to read. But when you're done with it, I think you'll actually understand a lot more about American history and what that might mean for you today, going forward, for us going forward. It's the words that made us, how we become a we. Volume one is 1760 to 1840, how these colonies actually came together. And they did come together, and they did come together indivisibly, Nikki Haley. So you got to get that secession thing right, okay? And it actually matters in America. And why we have a civil war, that's actually pretty important, too, and that matters today. So Volume 1 takes you up to 1840. Volume 2 takes you, I'm working on it now, from 1840 to 1920, and that's at the heart of the brief that I just wrote for the justices about actually what happened in the 1860s and the insurrections that led to 14th Amendment Section 3. That's the New York Times op-ed that's forthcoming. Well, the third volume will be 1920 to 2000. We need a history of our country because it's what we have in common. And here's what I promise you. It's not my personal views on things. I'm, for example, pro-choice, and I think Dobbs was right and Roe was wrong. You see, and my brother clerked for Harry Blackmun. But I personally don't have a gun, and I think Bruin was right and indeed cites me, and City of Chicago versus McDonald's was right and indeed cites me. So I'm not going to give you my personal political views. Too many law professors do that. I'm going to try to tell you what I think I've learned by studying our history as a country, and how actually that history informs this extraordinary document that we've been talking about, the Constitution of the United States. So my big ask is not that you have to buy it, there are libraries, but I would want you to read it. Thank you.
Thank you so much to the panelists for a great debate. And thank you to Lisa Ezell and to the Federalist Society for having us today. Thank you.